if that was the case. So the first question to answer is, how deep is it under still? Again, rough estimates, 3.7 million for repair if all those questions were answered and it was doable.
Robert, can I make a comment here?
Yes.
I would just add, just a takeaway from this slide for the board should be, it's really expensive to make a repair, and it's high risk. You know, if you have water egress that's even close, you know, that's a game stopper right there, because you only have so much cable to splice in. And if it's 2,001 foot, it's not going to work. So you can do all this mobilization stuff and bring it up. There's also a high risk that you'll damage the cable trying to pull it up and make a repair as well. Anyway, I just wanted to kind of linger on that just for a second. So the drivers right now are pushing us more toward a replacement as opposed to a repair, because it is very expensive and fairly high risk. And even if everything goes perfect, you still have to have a successful splice, right? And that's a weak point in there as well. So.
You raised another question, though. Going back to a point that Robert talked about early on his diagram.
Bob, can you hit the mic for me?
No, I'm sorry.
Please. Thank you.
Going back to Robert's point on the depth, yes. How do you make the determination whether you have water in there? How does that, is it just a guess, or how do you make that?
Okay, so, and in your report on page, and that's some of the testing that's going to be done in January, but on your report on page 4, the top figure 5, changes in the time domain reflectometer over time, that's A, because it's going to change over time as water migration occurs. And B, there is, we've already got all the calculations to make, or all the equations to do the calculations, but you take measurements at each of the bellows, so we'll connect pressure gauges to the bellows on each side, and determine how the pressures have changed since the onset of the fault. The change in pressure will also let you know how much migration has occurred. So combining the two, you can get rough estimates on where we are with migration.
Yep, thank you.
Yeah.
But in reality, until you get up on deck, start chopping it up, you're not going to know how far you have to go.
The reality is you're going to get a rough estimate from the tests to make a decision that this board can make a decision on whether or not it's doable. And then you don't really know until you cut chunks off it, throw it in a thing of oil, or a hot bath of oil. And if it boils, or if it starts splatting, it's just like water in your oil pot pan. It splatters.
Sizzles, yep.
It'll sizzle. And that's when they know, okay, sizzle, and got to go to the next one. And they'll keep taking pieces of that paper and throwing it in there, that paper that I showed you on that, and because that's, if it has any water in it, it's going to sizzle. That's kind of the sizzle test.
So, quick question. So, when I read through it, it wasn't very clear to me. Is there any scenarios that we're going to be talking about that include leaving that cable on the bottom?
We will go with our permitting. We've got a permitting firm, P&D. I don't think that's even an option. I'll let Trey answer this, but I think it's always recommended that you at least look at how you're going to get it up off. It's an oil, obviously, it's fluid filled, and just abandoning it in place. And Joel, maybe you can speak to this. I don't think it's been heard of unless you just can't get it up and there's nothing else you can do, and then trying to clean it and other things.
So if I may, through the chair.
Yes.
So our right-of-way lease requires us to, we can't abandon equipment per se. The only scenario that we'd leave it on the bottom is if we pulled it up and repaired it and stuck it back down. Otherwise, I think we're pretty strongly obligated to try to remove as much of the cable as possible. One thing that could possibly inhibit that is there may be a landslide on that bluff, or some major event that occurred there. It might be under 20 or 30 feet of rubble, and at that point, you know, you'd have to have some provision to cut it off as close as you possibly could. And then, and of course, there's a whole process anytime you work on this, you know, for flushing the cable and all that to try to clean it as much as you can as well. So, yeah, we don't, that's what we're hoping to get some more data on in that bluff area there to see is, you know, if we go do some more detailed investigation, maybe we see a large disturbed area or something like that, or either that or the depth monitor will say, yeah, it's, you know, it's 5, 10, 20 feet down under stuff, and, you know, the game over at that point. So, hopefully that answered the question.
Is it your idea then is to have that ready for the next board meeting to make some decisions, or what you're thinking?
So, this next round of testing is supposed to occur in January. Next board meeting is March. So, we'll get that next set of test data, filter that through our consultant and Robert and everybody else. You know, everybody's watching this because they don't have very many failures. So, everybody in the industry is interested on, you know, what the problem is and how they might repair it. So, no shortage of people wanting to weigh in on it. And so, hopefully, that'll provide enough information. I mean, clearly, if we went down there and there was 20 feet of silt on it, you know, we're headed toward putting a new cable in, right? Pretty strong. And there's some decisions that Robert will talk about a little bit more with regard to the new cable. This is just repair option here. The next one delves into actually replacement.
Joel, did you have something?
In my experience, part of your obligation to remove the cable, other than our existing permit, is the permit that we have to get. So some federal permitting authorities require, and I don't know the permitting regime that we have here, require to remove it. On the other hand, there's a possibility, I suppose, that if you're ultimately going to put in a new cable, maybe there's use for this cable in place to continue to be there. I mean, I know of a cable in Cross Hood Canal in Washington State that is just it's a backup feed. There's no power going through there at all, and so far the state has not required that one to be removed. So I think it's, among other things, it's could this be an open question.
This one's been completely failed, though. It's completely default, so it's not something you can use as a backup. So,
okay.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Those are all the possible concerns with repair and the possible high-level estimate. Going into replace, I wanted to start with first talking about failure modes in general for submarine cables. This data came from a study that was done, I think, on 104 submarine cables or something of that nature on root causes of subsea failures between 1991 and 2006. So you see a lot of it. You'll have environmental armor abrasion, 21%. You've got fishing, 10% of them had anchors, 6.7%, ships dragging their anchors, that kind of stuff. But what I want to point out in here is not very many insulation failures. And so you're not typically, you're going to fail your cable before you fail your insulation. So oversizing your cable to try and make your insulation failure rate go down is not really realistic. So the point of this is to show that we don't need to oversize the cable, which they are currently well oversized. Looking at just the power equation of those cables, typical 500 MCM cable at 90 degrees C is 450 amps. Just doing the math, it's about 107 MVA, like I mentioned. Petersburg only has a 20 MVA transformer, so can't really send that to Petersburg. And SEPA's only got 48 megawatts, so 50 MVA of full capacity, so it's double SEPA's even full capacity. Looking at what a cable half the size would be, that's a 250 MCM cable, and this is at 69 kV. So we reduce the voltage Because when I reduce this voltage insulation, it reduces the size of the cable because you don't have as much insulation. Take it down. And when I reduce the copper, I got less copper. So I reduce the insulation, I reduce the copper, and I still, even with a half the size cable, I still have twice the capacity of Peter's requirement. So this cable definitely can be some cost savings, a lot of cost savings, can be saved by downsizing. And then we got the repair cost estimates. And that's exactly what I did when I went out to a lot of these companies. I wanted to see what it would cost to replace as like in kind. Now these are three-phase cables. So we would, if we were to do a replacement, I've got preliminary estimate right now that I'm still trying to vet. But for single cables, it's significantly higher. Not the cost of the cable necessarily. Slightly higher, maybe another million on the cost of the cable if you were to do four singles. But also the cost of the installation is four times the work. You got to do it four times. But looking at this, we got Sumitomo. They just came in with their estimates. We asked for the like-in-kind, 138 kV, 500 MCM. We asked for 69 kV at 500 MCM, 138 kV at 250, and 69 kV at 250. Can we go smaller? That's the next question I have for them. So just getting estimates right now as we do all this other work.
This is for a single multi-conductor cable?
Single multi-conductor cable. The intent would be just to replace the spare.
There'd be three phases in a single line.
So, Robert, when you're looking at those estimates down below, like this low estimate of $6.3 million, that is the insulation and the removal?
That includes the removal cost. Now, these are estimates. So I got installation costs, it's $153,000 a day. We're thinking about 20 days. So $3 million for installation, 1.5 possibly for removal. This really depends on how hard it is to remove it. So 4.5 right there. And then you add the lowest cost cable we have, 1.7, so 5.5, 6.3. So, and these are really high estimates. We can save money here. We can also save money here by reducing these number of days. And also in the removal, if that thing is not really under very much silt, but we still have too much cable to repair, too much damaged cable to repair, then the removal is going to be pretty easy.
So, for me, we can spend all this money and try to get a repair in, and even if we do get it up and get a repair in, we got a compromised cable that we're going to send back down the water at the age that it is, and it's still a fluid-filled cable. Now, understanding that we can put another cable in there and the three that are operating can operate for another 20 years.
Right? Absolutely.
Potential. But to me, it makes sense, you know, for another $2.5 million, you put a brand new cable in that has three conductors ready to go. And I quite frankly should think we should put a fiber component to that cable also. I don't think it would cost much money, but I think we should put fiber across there because we don't know in the future what may happen in regards to that type of technology in Southeast Alaska. But if we're going to lay a submarine cable, I know that GCI had a failure there not too long ago that they had to replace, right? And if you look at the maps, the fiber cable goes right across our our transmission cable. So when we start pulling up and laying, we have the potential of damage, and I talked to Robert a little bit about it. Since we're grandfathered, we have first right there, and we're not held responsible for that kind of stuff. But I see we can go through a lot of Mickey Mouse to get something that we think we can fix. And if we can't fix it, we've spent all that money already, and we still have to continue on.
Is it possible for us to raise if we did the new cable, can we raise the other three and spool them and have them as spare for a potential on, is that the shortest run we have, or all of our other runs longer, or is it possible that we can raise the other ones and have them on hand as spares?
Some runs are longer, but whenever you pull a cable up off the bottom, you don't want to exceed the bend radius. And so when you're pulling it up, you're already challenged in that manner. And then in addition to that, whenever you spool up a cable, you don't want any water ingress at all. So if you could potentially spool it from the shore, you would do that. But if you had a fault like we have in that, like we have halfway down the incline here, when you spool it from shore, now what you're going to effectively do is start pushing that water down to the bottom of the incline. That is for potential, though. I mean, you can utilize existing cable as spare for other cable. It is quite possible if you can guarantee and do the testing after you remove it, that it's good.
Well, the thing is, we're going to put in this spare cable with three conductors, and we're not going to heat it up. It's going to sit there in the slot until we have a major failure in one of the other cables, I would think.
Would we have the ground? Because you're going to have to change your ground station to accommodate the new cable, correct? There's modifications to the ground station.
To the, you're talking about shore side.
Marine terminal?
Terminal.
Mm-hmm. So the marine terminals, and here's a kind of a picture. The marine terminals, the way these fluid-filled cables land, they've got what's called potheads. It's an electrical term. But a pothead just basically transitions from an underground service to an overhead service. And it helps with the stress it's an insulation type material with a gradient that helps with the stress relief of that transition. The potheads on these sides are basically just almost the same as a pothead with a standard underground service, except for they have oil fluid in them, and they have a way to connect to the cable. So the way they connect on top of them is exactly the same as any other underground service. It's just a paddle. So if you were to install a dry type pothead that is of similar height and bolt pattern, it would be a matter of just bolting it up there.
Okay. So it would be fast. You have to change the building up or?
Until you go to remove the other three cables. So on a full removal, you would have to get rid of all the whole station.
Okay. Sounds good. Sorry, one last question. Have we determined the condition of, say, banks to Mitkoff, because it's similar terrain, similar river influence? And the reason why I ask that is that if there's an issue, I know some of it we could near shore, we were having trouble near shore, I can't remember, but what I'm worried about is if we're going through this and we've moved up and we've got another cable on the other one that's not looking good either. I mean, is there potential for savings if we dealt with the other one? Were we able to get a good enough view on those cables to determine that they're in good shape?
It depends on what crossing we're talking.
I'm talking the banks to Mitkoff.
The bank that's on the other side?
Yeah.
Bank to Mitkoff wasn't too bad.
Okay.
The Stikine was the worst of them all, by far.
Well, we still have some near shore investigations to do as well that weren't completed during the ROV because they couldn't get that close. So we may use some of this newer technology with a smaller boat in order to get in and look at those items.
Yeah, because all I'm thinking about is if there is a big issue, and all of a sudden we see something, you can't predict the underwater avalanche, but if we see something, we could deal with it while they're up here. And I know it would be even more money, but it's got to be. So we at least save some
more
time.
Yeah.
Right. Go ahead, Clay.
So one of the potentially contributing factors to this failure is the steepness of the terrain. We've got those spans there, and as you can see, there's some special routing that had to be done for that particular cable. And the anomalies that you see as far as the terrain goes in this particular section, in respect to the Sumner crossing, the terrain doesn't look like that. It's much, much more subtle. It's much, much more gradual. And the area that we're going to have to, potentially do a follow-up and that was too shallow for us to do with the initial ROV survey, it is just that. It's shallower and it's, a lot less steep. So.
All right. So let's go ahead and move on get through this bargain.
Just one last question. That your cost estimates there, what I hear you say, that also includes the mob and demob of everything, including that $3 million?
Yeah, $153,000 per day, I think, right. Includes it.
Thanks.
And it's a high estimate. It's just really, at this point, to get us an idea of repair versus replacement, risk versus reward, I guess.
Well, I'll note too, just as a point of reference, our insurance only carries up to $5 million. So in this particular example, where we would be doing a replacement, obviously SEPA would be on the hook for potentially a couple million.
Yep. If insurance.
If insurance.
If there's insurance.
Yeah, and that's the key here. That's why I don't want to talk too much about insurance, because we have no idea what the root cause is of yet. And then finally, the last part of the report talks about the permitting process. We did contract the services of PND. They're great. They know Alaska. They know the processes. So, and finally, on the final page is the easements. Bob was mentioning it slightly there. GCI fiber optic cable. GCI actually had a fault. If you see where my laser is here, they actually had a fault right here. It's very high turbidity, lots of activity in here. But their cable goes across here, and they have an easement. 2017, they got their easement. This is our easement. Our easement states this is how I actually plotted this easement. It's from this right here. Kind of hard to see, but regardless, you can see it in color. And that is the easement that SEPA has. The cables lie inside that easement. And then GCI's easement is not as documented as this, but it is in the DNR report, and it does cross our cable, and it does talk about peaceful use of previous easements. So there's going to be some coordination that needs to be done between SEPA and GCI, whether it's repair or replace.
So, Robert, I would add that we have sent out a letter to GCI just to notify them, hey, we've got an issue there, and you might potentially be thinking that you might have to move your cable, so but put them on notice so they can prepare accordingly.
I think we should also take a little bit of a look at the new proposed marine mammal designated habitat stuff and see if that's going to mess with us at all in regard to what we do there. I think there's a...
That'll be part of the permitting process.
Well, I think there's a new regulation or designation that they're trying to put out. I think they were going to have a hearing in Petersburg in regards to that.
Yeah.
Another one.
Well, if you look at part of the permitting process, I think bullet item number 4 talks about National Marine Fishery Services and yep. Humpback whales, stellar sea lions.
Yep.
So NIFS, 3 to 6 month process as part of the USACE review, and a 9 to 12 month process obtaining an IHA. If that becomes part of the process, it could take a very long time to replace these.
All right. So did we have a calendar anywhere, Sharon?
Yeah, it's in the board packet.
It's in the written, I didn't see it.
Yeah.
Okay. So we got a calendar for year 220 and the meeting dates.
Talk about that one.
So we should talk about the strategic planning meeting plan for the 21st and 22nd. When I started thinking about this and talking about it with Joel and Trey, I thought that we had done a SEPA meeting in the past in Seattle. We met with some of our actuaries and different things that went on with that. So there's an opportunity to get some facilitators and other things in regards to having that meeting, and I think it would be very beneficial. So hopefully those dates work out for most everybody.
And can I recommend that we not do it in Seattle, given that our financial situation, we'd much rather have us keep it local in Ketchikan, or we've been worried about funding, and to have us go away to a planning meeting in Seattle, I think sends the wrong message.
Well, the other thing that we have, though, is we have council, and we're going to have some facilitators, and if we brought them up here, we're going to pay them.
That'd be more
for travel.
And we're already paying for hotels and rooms and food and stuff, so I didn't see where the, and I think there's a an opportunity to do this in, I think, a setting and with facilitators that will really help us out moving forward. And that's just my thought about this. I think it's important that we do this, and I think that there's some, probably some people that we can talk to that can come in and give us some good advice, and that's what we're doing.
By starting at 1 o'clock, are we technically to travel be that morning?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Arrived at about 12:30, and then we're right, okay.
Yep, that would be the plan.
Like a 2 half days, okay. And then go from there.
You guys have a
what?
The day before for us. Couldn't do it
yes,
one day.
Right.
Yeah, you guys are going to have to go the day before. Yeah. And so we might have to look at that because there might be a late flight. Something else that we can all do. I mean, we still got a long time out before we plan this
and see how it develops.
We need more time than we're talking about because if we're going to start talking about some of these policy things, that's going to take up a chunk of time also.
That was the point I was just going to make too. If you're going to do this, then probably ought to spend the time to complete whatever you decide to do.
And we can talk about that.
Plus, it'll take a little while to nail down facilitators and make sure they got a schedule and stuff too. So, we've started working on some of that a little bit already. Just putting some feelers out for availability, but it'll take a bit to put it together. And we want to get the highest value out of the exercise. So,
at that meeting, it will be a public meeting. We'll open it as we would any meeting. And then we'd have to go through the whole process with that. So. Yes.
So the 21st is, it's homecoming in right now, so there's basketball for some of us. And is there any benefit to moving it a week ahead? I mean, is that possible, or is this?
We just picked those dates that we haven't,
We can't move it ahead.
So if you flip back a couple of pages,
there's a whole bunch
right
of
meat behind that.
That's what's happening in Southeast Alaska.
It gives you an idea of some of the scheduling conflicts we have when we're attempting to fit things in. It gets pretty complicated with 3-member utilities and other commitments that folks might have.
But I think we can look at some of that and see if there's anything we can do. I mean,
That was it.
What if you co-located? I guess the other thing is to co-locate it with the March. You'd have to put it off, but the March board meeting.
I think the sooner the better.
2 days. That's already 2 days in range.
Well, let's put it down at that and see where it goes.
It's an option.
They didn't want to wait that long.
No, I know. So I think we're going to leave that date at this particular point penciled in, and then at that point in time, we would also install officers, correct?
Yes.
You'd have to have that and go through that process. Mm-hmm. And then our next regular meeting would be the 11th and 12th of March. With that, director's
regional tournament.
That guy's already got his calendar. His calendar's filled out. Board members' comments.
Again, I just have to compliment the staff on technical excellence. I just find these topics take huge amounts of experience and education and knowledge, and we are so lucky to have these people sitting in front of us. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Cliff.
I echo Robert's saying I'm always impressed by how well staff's prepared for the answers and preparation and all the information we need in front of us. So again,
Bob.
Thank everybody for all their work. And I can tell you, I send a note to Robert and it comes back faster than I can than anything, which is great, and I appreciate that. Just need to keep up all the contacts. Thank you.
Nick.
Yeah, thanks everybody again. I missed a couple of meetings this time, but wish you well in the next year, and I thank the staff for, I continue to be impressed with staff and Trey, so keep up the good work.
Thank you. Jack?
I echo Bob's and Dick's statements about the staff. I've always been impressed, very impressed with you guys, your knowledge. I appreciate that very much. And I thank you for the commendation, whatever it was. I appreciate that very much. Thanks.
Carl?
He said it all.
He said
that's my case. That's a cop-out, Carl.
Steve?
I think it's been some bumps this year, and I'm looking forward to the new year. That's a good thing about a new year. You get a restart at things, and I'm looking forward to seeing how we can work together and get through our issues. But I just want to wish everybody a very Merry Christmas, and hope everybody has a good one. So, thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to thank everybody that participated today. Some of this stuff isn't easy. I think, instill the idea that what's good for SEPA is good for the communities, and we should continue to work together. We got a real good thing going here compared to what some of the other communities are in and how they're set for power. And I think we just need to keep sight of the fact that it's to the benefit of the communities, and yet SEPA still has to manage its affairs somewhat separate, but with consideration for what's going on in our communities. And I again appreciate everybody's time and patience as we spend a whole day in this. It gets kind of long near the end, but I certainly appreciate your work. So thank you. And we start at 6?
We start at 6.
All right.
Move to adjourn, Mr. Chairman.
There's a motion. There's a second.
Second.
You have to call that?
I do.
Call the roll.
Let me get there.
All right.
Amelon.
Yes.
Severson.
Yes.
Coos.
Yes.
Lynn.
Yes.
Prasanka.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.